Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Today on One Broken Mom, I have the honor to be speaking with Ann Smith. Ann Smith is the president of Postpartum Support International. She is a PPD survivor and a lecturer on perinatal mood disorders to health professionals. She has a BA from Briarcliff College, a bachelor's in nursing from Cornell, and a master's in nursing from Columbia University. Ann has been practicing as a nurse, midwife, and a women's health practitioner for more than 30 years. She's three grown children and currently lives in New York City. And Ann became interested in perinatal mood disorders after suffering from severe anxiety and depression after her second and third child, before really much known information there was about treatment and the disorder overall. So this is a big deal, and I want to say welcome, Ann, to the show.
Thank you. I'm really, really pleased to be here, because anytime I get to talk about this subject, I love it. So here we go.
Awesome. Well, so this conversation, you know, you and I had talked earlier, but we had discussed that this is literally a conversation that can save lives. A lot of people are aware of the worst case scenarios because they are the ones that we end up seeing, unfortunately, on television and online. Probably one of the most famous ones in the United States. And it was hard to believe that this is actually 17 years ago. But when you mentioned the name Andrea Yates, sadly, you remember there's this Texas woman who drowned all five of her children in the bathtub after her husband had gone off to work. As a young woman, we seem to know that she suffered from eating disorders, depression, and suicidal thoughts. But on the other hand, she was a class valedictorian and an officer in the National Honor Society at her high school. And then just this year, I found one case, but I know that you had found some other ones. There's Mary Jo Troche, who in February shot herself, her husband, and her three-month-old daughter. Investigators say that the killing was actually a double murder-suicide, and they suspected that she was also suffering from postpartum psychosis. Her mother confirms that that was definitely what was going on with her daughter, and that she was struggling with being a first-time mom despite having supportive family and actually also working as a social worker in the mental health field. But she thought that stressful factors like breastfeeding, returning to work, and all of these things compounded and led up to these killings. So how often do these really terrible, terrible stories and cases actually happen here in the United States?
Well, it's interesting that we're starting our talk talking about what sometimes I call the dark side or the worst case scenario, because it is important for everybody to realize that this is not the usual face of postpartum depression, perinatal mood disorder. However, it is a very serious illness. We consider it a medical emergency. And what postpartum psychosis is a condition that causes a person to completely lose track of reality. She believes most of these mothers who have committed these awful situations have done it out of love. They believe that the child was possessed with the devil. They believe that the child would be closer to God. They actually have a belief that is so unreal and so bizarre that it puts them into a complete lack of reality. Now, interestingly enough, it occurs in 1 to 2 births per thousand. So that's less, way less than 1%. That's, what is that?
A tenth of a
0.1%
yeah.
or yeah. Yeah, something like that. Now, if we'd have to do the math, but if there are approximately 800,000 births, 4 million births a year in the United States, it's a quite a small number. But the thing that is important to know is that it is in that number, in that 1 to 2 per thousand, that these tragedies occur. And of that number, 4% will take the life of their infant or someone else in the home, and 5% will take their own life.
Wow.
So it is always, psychosis is always a medical emergency. It is always a 911 call. It is never a situation where you should wait and see. It is never a situation where the family should say, oh, she's just acting a little odd. Because we know now, going back where a tragedy has happened, that it could have most times been prevented.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody acted. This really is one of these, if you see something, say something. Because if suddenly somebody is seeing images that are not there, seeing people that are not there, believing things that are clearly totally off, suddenly having a relationship with some sort of a deity when they were completely a-religious before, these are very big warning signs. And friends, family, and others should immediately do something. Do not be embarrassed to do it.
Right. So, and I did a little bit of math. I mean, we're still talking about tens of thousands of families. And so while it may be a small number off of 4 million, it's still a significant number of families and mothers and children that are affected by that. So,
oh, yeah. Psychosis is a very real thing. And the interesting thing about postpartum psychosis, and you were right in talking about Andrea Yates. Andrea Yates was not only the valedictorian of her class, she went to the University of Texas at Austin. She was a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
She worked at MD Anderson, which is a big cancer hospital in Texas. So this was not, and her husband was a NASA engineer.
Mm-hmm.
This was not somebody that was in any way incompetent, and that's the important thing to know, that psychosis, like all perinatal mood disorders, is an equal opportunity
afflicted. Yeah, right.
It can happen to anyone, and in a huge percentage of cases, it is a first incident of mental illness.
Wow. Wow.
That's a very important thing to understand in terms of when we were talking a minute ago about if you say something, see something, say something, because people might say, well, she's never had anything wrong before.
Right.
And in fact, we should understand that in many cases, it is the first incident.
Yeah. So, you know, postpartum depression, but you've been mentioning perinatal mood disorder, and there has been a change in the language that's used around this topic in here. Can you explain why it's not just postpartum PPD, which is, like I said, what most people are more familiar with?
Well, interestingly enough, I both like that and hate that. I hate it because PPD is so much easier to say and to write and to understand. Mm-hmm. However, it doesn't explain the illness. And so, I will. We call it now perinatal mood and anxiety disorder. Big, lot of words because that's really what it is. First of all, it's perinatal, because in 30% of all cases, it begins during pregnancy. It is not strictly postpartum. So to be correct, we need to use the word perinatal around pregnancy, around birth. And the second part that is very true, and, you know, I can personally tell you this, it is not always depression. In fact, depression is probably true depression, you know, overwhelming sadness, can't move, can't get out of bed, can't do anything, have no interest in life, that sort of thing. That is probably number 3 in how people present. who have a perinatal mood and anxiety disorder. The number one is insomnia. The number two is anxiety. The number three is depression. And the number four is intrusive thoughts.
Oh, wow.
So those are, or some people would say intrusive thoughts before depression. So those are the presenting symptoms, not depression. And the reason that we want to make sure people know that is so many people say, well, I'm not depressed, really. And so I don't know what I have. And they don't seek help, or they don't think, they think it's something else, or they go months and months and months without treatment because they thought they were supposed to be depressed if they had postpartum depression.
Right.
So that's why the name has been changed to this cumbersome thing. And there are many other things that people call it. Sometimes I will abbreviate it, and when I'm writing something to somebody, I'll put PPD/A, you know, so that that kind of, a lot of women now are calling it PPA, postpartum anxiety. So there's a lot of different ways that it's termed. Some people call it maternal mental health complication. You know, there's a whole lot of things.
Right.
So we're basically all talking about the same illness.
Okay. So how many, you know, because I sit there and I think, well, if the one of the most common presenting symptoms is the insomnia and the anxiety, I see that and a lot of people saying, well, that's just, that's natural. That's normal. That comes with having a baby. You're anxious now because this is your first child, and all the stress and all the what ifs and am I doing this right and all that stuff seems like that's a natural part and normal during pregnancy. And so I can imagine then that those symptoms actually get easily dismissed by family members or, you know, other people when somebody says, listen, I'm feeling like super, you know, worked up about this and it doesn't feel right. But no, that's normal. That's fine. How many women truly are affected by a perinatal mood disorder, and how many of them are just feeling what would be the normal anxiety? I mean, you're a mom. I'm a mom, you know. I can say that I didn't feel some of these things that you did, but you did. I mean, you had it with, you know, two kids. So how many women do have something that would be classified as an illness and a disorder that we need to get serious about getting help for them?
PSI statistic is 1 in 7.
Wow.
That is 14%. There are some other places where you will read 1 in 5. That would be 20%. But what I always say to people is turn those numbers around. Even if it's 1 in 5, 4 in 5 don't have it. If it's 1 in 7, 6 in 7 don't have it. So there's clearly something going on with those of us who have it versus those people who do not, who have, feelings of being exhausted and overwhelmed and somewhat anxious. You know, has the baby gained enough weight? But it does not cross over into something that is crippling, something that is an obsession, something that where you can't get from Monday to Tuesday practically, then we know that you've got something that is very different than just the normal, oh gosh, you know, this is harder than I thought it would be kind of thing about being a new parent.
Right. Do you mind sharing a bit about what your experience was and how it affected you so that this might, you know, provide an example for somebody that's listening and wondering where they're at right now?
I'm fine with that. I actually always have been, but that brings up an interesting thing. Many women are not. There is a huge, huge stigma about talking about mental illness or anything that might be mental illness. There is an enormous stigma sharing in certain families. As you sort of alluded to a few minutes ago, a lot of families don't accept this. They don't want to accept it. They try to pass it off as something else. The idea of getting help is for sissies. Mm-hmm. They have bad feelings about the mental health industry, so to speak.
Right, head shrinks, clinics. Yeah,
there's a lot of problem with that. I felt so sick, and I had never had any experience with any kind of mood disorder or mental illness or anything before in my life. I felt so sick that I tell this story that if somebody had said to me, you can feel better by cutting off your right arm, I would have stuck my arm out and said, just do it. Don't even bother with any kind of anesthesia.
Wow.
That's how bad I felt. And so I had absolutely no problem telling people that. I told anybody who would listen, people who were professionals. I was already a nurse midwife for many years at this point. All of my colleagues, I kept saying, help me, somebody figure out what to do. But I now realize that so many people can't do that and are silenced. And, knowing how bad I felt, I feel terrible for those people because it must be extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm. Does a standard, I don't want to call it a standard case, but, for the sake of kind of compartmentalizing, does every case of postpartum or perinatal mood disorder evolve into psychosis? I mean, is there, does it?
Oh, no.
Right.
No,
so, and because I could see people
very clear.
Yeah.
Let's make that very clear. I want to make that really, really clear. It could be the most important point I make. Perinatal mood disorder, postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety does not morph into psychosis. They are two totally separate illnesses. They are separate from each other. They probably have a somewhat different cause. And so I don't want anybody out there listening thinking, oh my God, this is going to get worse and worse and worse, and eventually I'm going to become psychotic. Mm-hmm. No. Psychosis usually happens quite quickly, within the first 10 days to 2 weeks after the birth. Doesn't suddenly happen 4 months down the road, and it is its own specific illness.
Wow. Well, the Mary Jo in St. Louis, yeah, their daughter was 3 months old, and it was her first child. I mean, it wasn't like she was Andrew
Yates. And she had probably been exhibiting symptoms for some time.
Yeah, that's what's sad. Are men affected by this, by perinatal mood disorders?
Definitely. And it's something that we are just starting to recognize and do something with. Some people, the statistics are vary what you read. I have seen anywhere from 4% to 10% of men.
Hmm.
Men exhibit symptoms very, very differently, as they do in a lot of things. They tend to pull away. They tend to be withdrawn. The partner, the mom, or partner says they don't talk as much anymore. They don't share. They tend to, all of a sudden the guy is suddenly having to work these incredibly long shifts. So instead of working less to be home with the baby and the mom, he's working, double time. They tend to want to be with their man friends or go to their man cave. They tend to have sports on constantly. And these are their coping mechanisms. But unfortunately, what it seems to do is drive an even deeper wedge into an already difficult situation if the mom also has postpartum mental health things going on with her. It is also much more common when the mom does have a mood disorder,
mm-hmm.
because you see it a lot more. So it's something that is just starting to be looked at and addressed. There is excellent treatment for women, there is excellent treatment for men. So it's something that really should not be ignored.
Right. And when you and I talked about a month ago on the phone as we got to know each other and we were hashing the topic about and discussing it, you know, I had mentioned then that in the last couple of years, I've had a handful of my guy friends that have just had babies and much later in life, not like early 20 somethings, but, you know, men in their like mid to late 30s and even into their 40s. And within just the few early months after the baby, they were feeling this pressure that they weren't home enough, that they felt like they were being pressured to be there more, you know, and I kept telling him, like, you can't dismiss the fact that her life has just changed. I mean, she just birthed something and there is a biology to what happens to our bodies. I mean, it is, you know, childbirth and, you know, conception and all that. It's a biological function and a process. And there are so many things that happen to the human body to grow a baby and then to, you know, expel the baby and then have to, you know, the body has to recover and the body and the mind are linked together. And so I kept telling these guys, like, you need to cut her some slack right now. And you also need to, you know, see where you're at, like, you know, how you're feeling about this. You know, what is the biology that people need to understand about what happens to the human body, you know, through the pregnancy process that affects how we think and how we, you know, respond and react?
Well, I can certainly talk about it from the female standpoint. I probably can't do too good of a job with the male standpoint.
Fair enough.
Although there is some feeling that there are some hormonal influences that go on when a man changes in hormone level during pregnancy and all that kind of thing, when a man is becoming and does become a father, that has influence on them getting postpartum depression.
Yeah, I would imagine serotonin is a chemical all of our, you know, bodies produce that, you know, create bonds and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's not surprising that it would happen to them, that they'd be triggered that way too.
Yeah, exactly. At risk of, you know, making somebody upset, I'm going to say that I would suspect that the depression and anxiety that comes in men is more situational than in women, and women is more biological, but I'm sure you're going to have somebody screaming at you. That woman didn't know what she was talking about. So I don't want to go too far down that road.
All right.
With women, it is definitely a biological illness. There is no question about it. The trouble is that in August of 2018, we don't completely understand the biology. And here's what I can kind of explain. We know enough about the genetics now that we know, or we're pretty sure we know, that some of us have a gene that makes us more susceptible to change in hormone levels. So a lot of women will say to me, oh, it's my hormones. If only my hormones would get back to normal. Actually, that's not right. It's the change in the hormones that created the cascade of events that threw off all of the things like what you were talking about, the serotonin and the neurotransmitters of the brain and the cortisol and all of these things that change and affect the emotions. So it's not the hormones per se. It's the rapid rise and or rapid drop that occurs after birth. And then, of course, there are lactation hormones that create lactation that support it and all of that kind of thing. And so for some women, most women, those are friendly hormones. Those are oxytocin and prolactin and progesterone and all that are friendly hormones. Those are hormones that our bodies like. In fact, I can say that the only time I felt really okay was when I was nursing.
Mm-hmm.
But some people do not have that. Is it that they're missing it biologically? Is it that there's something more that goes on? We don't really know. And we also see, and this is a sort of a little bit of a caution and a warning, when people wean, we sometimes see a huge crash. In other words, somebody has been doing okay. Maybe they're not great, but they're hanging on and they're sort of doing okay and they're kind of pulling it together. And then for whatever reason, they wean. And the next thing you know, you've got a real acute situation on your hands.
Right. And you're talking about weaning from breastfeeding. Right.
I would say possibly from pumping, because there are people who exclusively pump. And that, of course, is also going to trigger those same hormones I was talking about. Because if you can't, if you don't have those hormones, you're not going to be able to pump anything more than a couple of drops. So I think that could be. But yes, that is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
It's not putting the baby on a cup. It's weaning from breastfeeding, because that is a highly, highly biological phenomenon.
Right, right. And that's one of those, too, that there's so much cultural and social stigmas with it as well. I mean, we're trying to get through it. We're, you know, being accepting of women doing it in public, for one. But I also see, you know, younger mothers that, you know, feel like they're unsuccessful at it, that they don't feel like they're actually nourishing their child enough. And then it's conflicted with, well, now I got to go back to work. And so I'm going to stop doing this. You know, some women are able to breastfeed for years, and some, you know, depending on the child, can go 3 to 6 months, 6 months on the high end. And then by them, I remember this piece of it. There is this little bit of you that feels dejected as a woman, because you know that you've got these breasts on your chest for a reason, right? And they're supposed to take care of your kid. But if you don't feel like you're doing it really well, then when you choose to stop doing it, there's a letdown. And, you know, letdown is a term used in lactation as well. But there's that emotional letdown of like, I wish I could have done this better and I didn't. And, you know, and like I said, I don't feel like I've classified in this party of, you know, the small group of women that had it. But that is a feeling that comes with the weaning process of the, this is over, maybe I didn't do it as well as I wanted to, and all that little bit of stuff. That, so I can see where that would be like a huge change emotionally, especially if you have the gene, you know, that's going to make you more inclined to develop the more serious symptoms.
That's right. Yeah. I think you're onto something there. I think I happen to, and this is just has really very little to do with what we're talking about. This is my other hat. This is me as a midwife, me as a lactation consultant. I blame terribly our American way of birth and medical establishment for the fact that so many women feel inadequate. And I believe that it's because they are not given enough guidance and enough handholding. When I worked at a birth center, you know, everybody breastfed, everybody was successful at it, nobody had problems. And I think it's because we were there 24/7. The midwives to hold their hands, and we'd bring them in. We'd watch them nurse. We'd position the baby. We'd bring them in the next day if they had to come in. You know, it was just, we gave them so much support. And our moms today don't really get much support in the initial few days and weeks. In England, the midwife goes in once a day for 21 days, is my understanding, to make sure everything's going well. Yeah, so no wonder so many of our moms feel inadequate and do have trouble with it. I think it's not their problem. I think it's our problem. But again, that's just a totally, you can edit this out if you want.
Oh, I am not editing it out. I'm leaving it in, and I'm making it its own clip, because I think you're on that. And, you know, it's related. It's related to this, because we're talking about how we feel about being moms, you know, and what affects us, you know, to some extreme. Some people suffer from it more deeply, but there is this, you know, you want to have this loving, great experience, but it's not always the case throughout pregnancy. And I think you're on it. Like I do think about a lot of moms that, you know, I spent a lot of time by myself. You know, I had a baby and there wasn't a nurse midwife. There wasn't, you know, every once in a while, my mother-in-law came by. But it is a, it feels like it's a very solitary, you know, world right now with parents. And maybe dad is there if there is a dad. But what is dad going to help us with lactating? You know, I mean, what do they know about it? And so, no, I think you're spot on. I'm keeping it in, Ann. I'm glad you went there.
Okay. But anyway, yes, there. So that I just, well, the reason I said originally the thing about weaning is that there are a lot of women who are told to wean. You will feel better. Just wean. And they're told that by medical professionals, by therapists, by all kinds of people. And sometimes that is good advice if they are struggling to the point where it is just a fight and a battle and, you know, awful. But sometimes if they're doing pretty well, it's the only thing that's making them feel okay. And to tell them to wean is really, really bad advice, and that you will end up with a big, big disaster on your hands. Mm-hmm. So I am appealing both to moms not to listen and medical professionals not to do it if the mom is nursing and doing fairly well at it.
Right. And you said for you, that's when you actually felt good was during that, was while you were breastfeeding, right? Mm-hmm.
I thought I was unique at the time, but now I have learned that that is not at all unique, that that's quite common. Yeah. I think it's from both two things. I think it's because there is a hormone that is excreted, that is a feel-good calming hormone, mm-hmm. but also because it makes you feel like, wow, this is something I can do, right. as long as it's going well.
Right.
You know?
Yep. Yep. So what are the major symptoms people need to be looking out for with Amy? You talked about insomnia and anxiety, but, you know, what do those actually look like? What are the forms that those take, anxiety and depression and intrusive thoughts?
So insomnia is a word that gets thrown around. You know, we all know that. Oh, I have terrible insomnia. Well, what it might mean is it took you a half an hour to get to sleep, or, you know, you woke up three times a night, or you woke up at 4 o'clock and you couldn't get back to sleep, but actually you'd been asleep since 10 or 11. That's not insomnia. That's not the kind of insomnia that I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is you cannot sleep. You know, the baby's sleeping, the baby's quiet. We all know that newborns wake up a lot, but you can't sleep. You feel like you've had 100 cups of coffee. You can't get to sleep, or if you do get to sleep, you can't stay asleep a couple minutes at a time. And as we all know, lack of sleep is a form of torture.
Yeah.
And eventually it makes the mind go crazy. It makes the mind go off. So insomnia is both a symptom and causes a problem, because, you know, it's a symptom of the illness, but insomnia itself causes more problems. So it is one of the first things that when somebody gets treatment that they will try to solve mm-hmm. for them, is to make sure that they get sleep. In fact, there are even some very well thought of psychiatrists who will put somebody on some kind of sleep aid for 5 nights or a week and see how they are at the end of that time before they treat them with anything else.
Right, right. And that makes total sense when you experience that. Yeah.
It can be so important. So that is the number one. And that is the one thing that if somebody has any tendencies towards psychosis, can push them over into it. Mm-hmm. That is the one thing. So anyway, so that's the kind of insomnia I'm talking about. Severe, intractable, you know, you get 2 hours of sleep in 3 days, kind of that sort of thing. That's the kind of insomnia that I'm talking about.
Okay.
Many times the insomnia is brought on by anxiety. And again, it's the 100,000 cups of coffee. It's that jittery feeling. It's that feeling like you can't get enough air. It's that feeling like you're mind is spinning over and over. You know, when you're worried about the baby not breathing, then after you've checked the baby, you worry about, is it too hot in the room? Is it too cold in the room? Or you have what I had, which is a formless kind of fear. I didn't have a fear of things having to do with the baby or taking care of the baby or ability to nurse the baby or any of that kind of thing. I just had this fear. Mm-hmm. This fear, that thing like Roosevelt said, a fear of fear itself. I mean, there was just this fear. And what that is connected to, we know biologically, is the fight or flight thing. You know, as animals, we are still have a fight or flight response in us. All of us have felt it when we have had a near miss. We've almost had an automobile accident, or we get a phone call that's scary or something like that. We've had that kind of feeling in your chest, that sort of nausea, everything shuts down, that just awful feeling. So we all know what that feels like. And so what you have to think about is having that all the time. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the inappropriate excretion of the cortisol and some of the other,
like adrenaline,
and some of the other, fight or flight, hormones. And the problem is, you know, there's nothing to fight and we can't flee. So, you know, although talking about fleeing, exercise is very helpful for many people. And when you first deliver, you're not supposed to, you know, exercise heavily, but just, you know, doing some dance moves or going for a walk around the block or something like that can really be very helpful. So that's anxiety. And there are, you know, there are many other forms of anxiety. Again, I think this might be the right place to talk about the mild to severe. So we look at all of these mood and anxiety disorders on a spectrum, from mild to severe. And not everybody. I tend to describe when I'm talking the moderate to severe end, because that is the people that sort of seek me out the most and the people that I tend to be the most effective helping for some reason. And so when I'm talking about this, I'm kind of talking about moderate to severe side, but the mild side, we don't want to ignore those people either, because they are not feeling. Somebody wrote me this morning early and said, I feel off. And I said, and so my reply was, what is off? And off is just not right. I'm not enjoying my life. I'm not happy with the baby. I'm feeling constantly on edge. I'm feeling I shouldn't have done this. Why did I do this? Where is my old me? And if those things, what I say to somebody when they say is, should I get treated? I say, is this interfering with your quality of life? Or can you just kind of brush it off and get on with things and say, you know, get over it, so-and-so. You know, because some people can. Some people can actually talk themselves out of this stuff. Come on. Yeah. Let's go. You know, we're good. Whatever. But if it's really interfering with your quality of life, you need treatment.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you that. Like, what's the tipping point about getting serious, and whether or not some of this can be self-help, that you can push yourself through it or get by with it? Because I guess I'd be sitting here thinking, and you know, I am sitting here thinking, you know, you've described a lot of these things to me, and other people are listening to this. And I'm concerned, like, if I feel this way now, like I write out to you like this person did and said, I feel off today, do I need to be worried that tomorrow it'll be worse? Because I guess that's the one thing.
So
about
that's what I say to people when we're trying to judge. I say, when I'm not sure and I don't think the person is sure. Now, this is somebody who's been very ill. Mm-hmm. So she's actually feeling off is a huge improvement. You know, so you're looking at it from the other way, which is feeling off might be we're not sure quite what's going on yet. And that's what I say. I'll say to somebody, let's stay in touch. Let's see how it goes. One of three things is going to happen. You're going to feel better. You're going to feel the same. Or you're going to feel worse. It's going to declare itself. Mm-hmm. We're going to know where you're headed. And if after a week or 10 days you're feeling much better, we know that you're starting to come out of it, whether it's because of your own biology or whether it's because you've been able to get back to using your coping mechanisms again. Mm-hmm. See, what happens to most people is the illness sort of detaches them from their coping mechanisms. We all have coping mechanisms that we use to handle things. And sometimes those coping mechanisms are very good and healthy, and some people have some not so healthy coping mechanisms, but we all have them. Mm-hmm. The trouble with this is you can't access them. You can't get to them. Mm-hmm. They're gone. And so sometimes you can get them back by yourself. Sometimes you can get them back just by doing some activities, getting back to doing things, seeing friends, going places, going to a support group. Mm-hmm. You know, the three legs of the stool of treatment tend to be, for many people, therapy, medication, and support. Going to a support group, seeing other moms that are having some difficulties. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes, I guess to answer your question, some people can kind of get themselves out of it, and not everybody needs treatment. Okay. Mild, the rule of thumb, I mean, this is a, you know, standard rule of thumb. Mild illness can many times be handled just by support and some therapy. Mm-hmm. Moderate to severe really usually needs medication and therapy and support.
To kind of get the chemicals balanced back in, I imagine.
To recover. Yep. To recover, to get back to, you know, enjoying your life, which is the whole thing. You don't want to lose those first 9, 12, 14, 17 months of your baby and look back when the baby's 6 and say, I was so miserable, I didn't enjoy this time.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why I encourage, you know, treatment as soon as possible, because you want to enjoy that. You want that to be a memory that you can keep. The quickest way to recovery tends to be that combination, medication, therapy, and support. Not everyone can find it. Not everyone can get it. There are parts of this country that are underserved, but PSI can usually help you find somebody that knows how to treat and knows how to help, as long as you are willing to travel a bit. I'm not saying hundreds and hundreds of miles, but we may not be able to find you somebody that's right there on your street corner.
Right. Well, and I was going to say, you know, and I'm glad you segued into this, because, you know, how well known are these illnesses really throughout? Like, you would go to your OBGYN, you know, if you were sitting there after you had your baby, or your midwife, or, you know, whoever helped support you through the delivery process, and sit there and go, I'm having these, you know, feelings and thoughts and stuff like that. It feels like it sometimes, though, you might run into a health practitioner that isn't as up to speed on what the latest understanding is of this. And my concern is that somebody might get the message that it's normal, it's fine, you'll be all right, and be dismissive of maybe what they're feeling. So what does Postpartum Support International do for anybody that's listening to help them, you know, kind of seek out what they might need to know and the help they might need to get?
Well, first, let me address your first piece of that, which is the OB providers. You're right. There are still some that are not as knowledgeable as they should be.
Right. They're lacking information.
But they're much, much better. And I have been surprised in the last year or so how many times somebody will get fairly good advice from their OB, or that their OB or midwife will know about this and either know how to treat themselves or have good referral sources for the mom. So that's, you know, we should be encouraged by that. That has, we have come a ways with that than from how it used to be. And as I think I told you when we were on the phone before, PSI does have a training program that is specifically aimed at what we call frontline providers, OBs, midwives, nurse practitioners, pediatricians, general practitioners, GPs, who are likely to be the first people to see the mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as they avail themselves of this program, that will, you know, in fairly short order, give them the basics that they need, I'm hoping for good things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm hoping for even better reception from the OB and the general practitioner. We'll see. But anyway, if you were, so here's the problem. If you got kind of snubbed, and if you're kind of reluctant to reach out, if you're somebody like me, or maybe even you, I bet, and you got snubbed, you know, you're not going to take no for an answer. You're going to look somewhere else. You're going to say, okay, that guy's a fool. Let me see who I can find that knows something, right?
Yeah, right.
But that's not the norm. There are an awful lot of moms out there that if they get snubbed, you know, it took a lot for them to reach out at all. And now they got snubbed and now they're really scared or really feeling down or really feeling inadequate, right?
Yep.
And so, I guess what we want everybody to know, everybody, is that PSI, Postpartum Support International, is there for this reason. This is what we do. Mm-hmm. We find help. We can find virtually anybody help. I have somebody in Florida right now who has terrible intrusive thoughts and what we call what ifs. What ifs is a form of intrusive thought. The most bizarre, you know, what if the roof caved in? What if I got in a car accident and the car caught fire? I mean, they are just these, it's just your mind short circuiting and going nuts. And this poor lady, she's being treated pretty well medically and she is beginning to improve. But what she really, really needs is a good therapist who has experience in what ifs. Because a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. What ifs are pretty hard to treat. That, you know, you need a specific type of therapy and it tends to be cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah. And there's nobody in her particular area of Florida who, there's some therapists, but they, you know, they go in and you tell them your troubles and you leave.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody that does this particular type of therapy, and she wasn't really having much success. And so we got in touch, she and I together got in touch with a coordinator, and this wonderful coordinator searched and searched and searched until she found somebody who was trained and did cognitive behavioral therapy and was very comfortable with what ifs and intrusive thoughts. And she does teletherapy. And so she's going to have a video or however, whatever you people call it, different things. But anyway, I'm going to have video therapy. And which has just, there's just been an article published about this saying that it is as effective, if not more effective than in-person therapy. So my point is, this is what PSI will do for you. If any mom or dad, or grandmother. I mean, many times somebody who's a family member reaches out to us and says, we need you, and I can't get my daughter to call. And then we figure out how to work with that. But we also now have a texting option, which a lot of younger people don't like to talk on the phone or talk. You know, they really, it's true, they don't.
Right.
And but they'll text, and we have a texting option. I don't have the number in front of me right this sec, but we'll
put
get
the link
it
on. Yep,
so that you'll have it. You'll put the link on. There is a texting option. You can text into PSI Tell us what you want. We always need to know what the issue is. I mean, you don't have to do it, you know, when you leave the message, because the 1-800-944-4PPD or 4773, that number is not answered live. There is a message that tells you what to do. You leave a message with your contact info and someone will get back to you within an hour or two. When you speak in person or text in person, and that is when they need to know what it is you need. You know, what's going on? How can we help? A lot of people call in and just sort of don't give us enough information so we can help them. And again, that's probably just because they're insecure and timid and a little bit afraid to reach out. But PSI, no matter what your doctor has said, no matter how negative a response you may have gotten, we will take PSI, will take it seriously. And we will find somebody, as long as you're willing to drive. I think Carrie Banks, who's in charge of all this, says you have to be willing to drive 25 miles or to travel 25 miles. We can't guarantee to find you somebody within a mile, but we can usually do it as long as you can travel 25.
Yeah.
And most people, you know, in most parts of the country, you know, that's a quick trip. I mean, there are people that don't have a car, or can't get access, or have to rely on public transportation. And then, you know, we can work with that too.
Yeah. I want to probably resonate on how I know you're feeling. Like you talked about you and I being of similar personality, and I think we are. I guess what I want people listening to this is that trust your gut. So, and that's what you're saying is you might go to a doctor or a health professional and you might have these really non-specific feelings. Like you said, that one woman that's been, you know, saying just not feeling right. If they give you an answer and it doesn't make you feel like, you know, they understand, or you still don't, your gut saying, I still don't think that that's correct. That's what you're saying is like, you need to continue to reach out. And if your next call or, you know, email is to PSI, go there. Because to me, I've always said this to people, maybe you can agree or disagree with this, but I don't ever believe that you go too far when you're reaching out for help. You know, that there's no overdoing it when it comes to either showing support for somebody that you think is maybe needs some help around this, you know, mom that's unwilling to admit that her anxiety really is affecting her. You can't overdo it. You know, you never can. You can never overdo it by reaching out or getting somebody some assistance. You know, the worst thing that happens is that a therapist or a doctor, you know, genuinely says you're fine, like you're okay here. But everybody knows inside of them if they're feeling, if this is okay or not okay for them. And if it's not, then reaching out and, you know, just that's the least you can do. I did find on your website here the help, the warm line. So I will include that on for the resources, you know, attached to this broadcast and this podcast episode. So everybody that's listening, you'll be able to go to the website. You'll be able to go to the podcast notes and see how to get to those phone numbers and stuff.
You're right about the help.
Yeah.
And you're right about it, not only about this. I can talk about this in terms of other medical things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people take the first thing that the doctor says, or the doctor says, you need an operation on your knee. Do they get a second opinion? No, that's crazy. It's always, always necessary. Whether it's your knee, your heart, or your mind.
Well, and you know, the other thing too that I'm compelled by, you know, why I do my podcasting and why I cover a broad variety of topics is that we really have learned so much medically in just the last 20 years. And 20 years feels like a long time, but yet I can also sit there and go, man, that went by in a blink for me. And that's the point, is that even relying on maybe what your mom or your grandmother is telling you is the norm and is okay is vastly different from what they knew and grew up with and what we truly understand. And especially around the world of mental wellness, like there's a whole lot going on, you know, understanding biology and neurobiology about what causes these things. And I know you and I didn't talk about this, but we talked about it in our phone call. You mentioned cognitive behavior therapy, and we had discussed that there, you know, there may be some links to childhood experiences and trauma, which isn't your forte, but you gave me the name of somebody who does, you know, go into that. And so that's a direction I will go with it. Because some of that may lend into why some people develop, you know, a mood disorder like this and why some don't.
Yes.
And so this is it's an amazingly broad topic, but yet so important. And, you know, like I said, we started the top of this episode with the worst case scenario, which happens extremely in rare situations. But yet there are women and families out there that are dealing with this and suffering from it that don't need to. And I know you told me one big message you want out here is that there is treatment. You don't have to suffer with this.
Well, the one thing that we haven't talked about, and I don't know whether you want to, whether there's time, whether you want to
always
edit something in order to put this in, and that is treatment. What are the different treatments and stuff like that? And because there is a great deal of misinformation and misconception about treatment.
Well, let's do it. Yeah.
So remember I said that for mild cases, and that again can only be really assessed by a professional, whether it's mild or moderate or severe or somewhere in between. But anyway, for those cases, many times, therapy, whether it's interpersonal, whether it's trauma-informed, as you were referring to, or whether it's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, one of those, you know, and what we call, for this, we use what's known as targeted therapy. This is not the kind of therapy where you go back to what happened as a child and have hundreds and hundreds of sessions over years that deal with that. This is how to get this person well fast. Mm-hmm. How to give them the skills and the coping skills and the tools that they need to deal with what they're dealing with. And many people will tell you that you can treat this in 10 sessions, depending on the severity and that type of thing. So, you know, anyway, this is not a lifelong or a many years long kind of a thing. It's targeted therapy.
Yeah, sounds like
that's for the mild. Yeah, that's for the mild sort of situation. And then when we get into the moderate to severe, as I said before, usually that should be combined with some medication. The interesting thing about medication is that we've had decent psychiatric medications for 25-30 years or more, in some cases. They are more effective for perinatal mood disorders than for any other form of mental health problem. They get people well. In fact, I tell a cute story, I think it's cute, about my original partner in my support group that I ran, who told me after 6 months she didn't want to do it with me anymore. And I was horrified that it was something that I was doing wrong. And she said, no, they get better too fast. She liked the long-term therapeutic groups that went on and on and on. She hated it that these moms would come two or three or four times, and then they'd stop coming because they had a newborn and their medication kicked in and they were feeling good. So anyway, that's how well medication tends to work. The moms on our Facebook group did a little survey just among themselves. We didn't do it. And somebody said, what has helped you get well the most? And about 60 people, you know, chimed in. And I looked at it and I tallied it all up to see 45 of the 50 said, of the 60 said medication as number one.
Wow.
So that shows you, and it's usually the SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, sometimes SNRIs. Those are things, so the first ones are Zoloft, Paxil, Prozac, Lexapro. The second ones are Cymbalt, Effexor, that kind of stuff. And for most people, they are extremely effective, have relatively few side effects, and work within a couple of weeks. They don't work instantly. That's the tough part. There are a smaller percent that will need to switch. In other words, they'll need to, the first one isn't the right one for them, and they'll need to move over to something else. The part that I want to talk about is safety. This is where OBs and GPs tend to be really, really off. they have not kept up with the perinatal reproductive psychiatry experts. They are still telling moms to go off before they conceive, or if they see them in first trimester, they'll take them off sometimes. Not everybody, but that's what's happening. And there are still doctors saying no medications during breastfeeding or only Zoloft. That is what I was told 20-something years ago. That is completely not the case anymore. Obviously, there is risk in anything you do in life, including stepping out of your back door. But there have been countless studies showing absolutely no increase in malformations in fetuses over the norm. And so what people don't understand is that there is a baseline 3% malformation rate in any pregnancy. So when you measure malformations, you have to say, is taking Prozac causing more than the 3% baseline? And nothing has shown that it is. Nothing. Ever. So all of the good and expert reproductive psychiatrists are fine with prescribing during pregnancy if somebody needs it. It's obviously risk versus need or benefit, and we know that a severely depressed or anxious mom during pregnancy is very dangerous for the fetus in many different ways, many ways.
Right.
That is something that all of our listeners should be, your listeners should be understanding. And the same goes for breastfeeding, even more, you know, that is very safe. There are just a couple of things that people are, you know, very few things that are mean that you couldn't breastfeed.
Right.
So there's a wonderful organization called Infant Risk. Its website is infantrisk.com. It's Dr. Thomas Hale down at Texas Tech. And I'm not sure where in Texas. And he is a psychopharmacologist, and he has this incredible program. It's a great website. You can look up any medication that you need to look up, and they even have a wonderful hotline that a mom can call and say, you know, my doctor is thinking of prescribing XYZ. Could you tell me about it? Or the doctor can call and say, you know, I'd like to put Mrs. So-and-so, or not, that wouldn't give the name. I'd like to put my patient on, you know, on Cymbalta. She's taken it before. It's worked well. Is that okay during pregnancy? And they'll, you know, they'll actually talk to them.
Well, that's really great. And, you know, that's...
Tell them what their statistics are. Yeah.
Yeah, because everybody's concerned when you're, you know, carrying a baby and breastfeeding afterwards, you know, that you don't want to pass along, you know, anything to them. But you're right, there's a maternal fetal stress is probably not better, you know. And I don't think a lot of people, that with the mom's body being under stress, that she's passing through, you know, those hormones and chemicals anyways that her body's naturally producing. And so if regulating that helps the baby, you know, through doing it through the use of a prescription medication. And it's a temporary thing, right? I mean, not every mother that has to go down that path is something that she's on the medication for the rest of her life, right? I mean,
not at all. Yeah, not at all. Especially if she has not had mental health situation before. Many times, we usually say 9 to 12 months to make sure, after you have recovered, to make sure that the neurotransmitters really are rebalanced. Mm-hmm. And everything is, because if you go off sooner, you do tend to have a significant relapse. Mm-hmm. So 9 to 12 months is usually the minimum period of time that is recommended to be on the medication. But then you can see how it is coming off. You do it very, very, very slowly. And some people will end up going back on for another 6 months or a year and then coming off. Other people who have really had an underlying mental health problem that was unrecognized, untreated, and acknowledged will suddenly feel fine for the first time in their lives and stay on. And there's nothing wrong with that. So far as we know, that these medications have no long-term harmful side effects. And I will just quickly comment on alternatives. So there's a huge push for people to find a, quote, natural remedy. And so any remedy that's going to work is not natural because it has some ingredient in it that is causing it to work. And just because it's the flower of a plant or the leaf of a tree doesn't make it any more natural, really, or any safer. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
So the issue with the those natural things is that they are entirely unregulated and unresearched, as opposed to the stuff we've been talking about that has had hundreds of well-controlled research studies done on them. We don't know whether something is safe. We don't know whether something's okay for a fetus. We don't know if it's going to work. We don't know if it's going to combine with another medication you may need to be on for something else and cause some kind of
side effect. Yeah.
Yeah. Bad combination. And so I say to people, really proceed with caution. Don't just, one of the good things about the internet is you can find out about stuff. One of the bad things about the internet is you can find out about stuff and you can hear people chatting. And there is a huge amount of junk science out there.
Yeah, there definitely is. Yeah, oh, totally agree.
This should be, if you are, I mean, there are certain things that we know to be helpful. Vitamin D, we know to be helpful. Omega-3, fish oil, we know to be helpful. Good quality lean protein, we know to be helpful. Exercise, we know to be helpful. Massage, we know to be helpful. Acupuncture, we know to be helpful. But when it comes to various oils and, you know, the one right now is CBD oil, nobody knows what that is, what it does, whether it's healthy, whether it could cause any, nobody knows. It's just, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying nobody knows.
Right. And I think that's the thing, you know, because I do know a lot of people in my own circle, because I actually have rheumatoid arthritis. And so, and I treat it with, you know, I treat it with pharmaceuticals. You know, that's, it's what controls the disease. It's what, you know, makes the quality of my life better. But for, you know, every time the word is mentioned, I get a well-meaning, but have you tried this, which is, you know, some kind of undocumented, or they try to send me an article that shows that it's documented, but it's a natural process. And then this accusation that I don't need to use these drugs to cure this. And it's like, you know what, if I could have done this by just not by cutting tomatoes out of my diet, I would have done that, but it's not working because we're beyond that. You know, and it's not to minimize that there aren't opportunities, but like what you're saying is they're not all as well understood. And and so the future may be there that we'll find some new breakthroughs. And I know that especially with the medical marijuana because of the legalization. And I live in a state where it's legal now and you know, and adjacent to a few other states. So people are pushing it as remedy to it. And there are cases of where it's helped. But in this particular area of where we're talking about a mood disorder, pregnancy, there's just nothing there yet to get us to a place where it's like it's on par with what we do know works and what we do know is safe for the baby.
And we know how it works. It's scary to use something that you have no idea how it works when you're already dealing with something that is wrong with the emotion.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to cause a worse problem than what you've already got.
Yeah. And ultimately, I mean, what this is about is it is the quality of the relationship that you have with your family, with this child that you have, with yourself. And, you know, that is not something that you should have to accept, you know, anything less than being happy with it. And, you know, because it it may guide you. It may shape you. But I mean, like you said, you don't want to feel like you missed out, you know, in the early days and the early months of having a baby, you know, by just dealing with, or, you know, just subjecting yourself to unnecessary anxiety and pain and depression and sadness and all the things that, you know, you want to feel good about it. So, and you can, just,
yes.
And the support
there is treatment. We are so lucky in certain ways that we are talking today about an illness that has treatment. Mm-hmm. Because there are an awful lot of things out there that don't have treatment.
Right.
Where those organizations and those foundations that are trying to work with it are trying to find cures and trying to just help with a quality of life with the people who have it.
Right.
But we've got treatment, and it galls me that only 30% of women who should have treatment do get treatment. I hate that. It says a lot about a lot of things. But the good news is that PSI can help with that. As we said, don't take no for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is help. And we'll help you get it.
Great. And I know Postpartum has a website. You've got a Facebook group. There are several Facebook pages if somebody goes on the search bar on Facebook and looks up Postpartum Support International, you'll find a local chapter possibly in your area, as well as the international organization, which I believe is out of Oregon, which is one of my neighbors. But you're in New York.
It's Portland, Oregon, but we're virtually
everywhere.
You know,
yeah.
We're all, there's a representative, there's a coordinator in every state.
Yeah.
And, there is also an online support group that people be potentially interested in, I think, in both Spanish and English.
Mm-hmm.
There is a dad's chat, which is a wonderful thing. It's the first Monday of every month with Dr. Daniel Singley, who's an expert on this. And anybody can call in and talk about any concerns that they have about being a dad, either for themselves or for their family. People really, really get a lot out of that. And then there's a mom's chat every Wednesday. It goes back and forth. We call it chat with an expert, because there will be an expert, perinatal mood and anxiety disorder specialist on the phone. And it goes back and forth between being, depending on your time zone, noontime, on the East Coast and 8 p.m. on the East Coast. So that would be what, 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And so one week it's the daytime, the earlier one, and the next week it's the later one. I also would say that any of you who are prescribers or who are in contact with a prescriber, they can utilize the consultation line. And that is a brand new project that has just started up, which is that any prescriber can call 1-800-944-4PPD extension 4 and set up an appointment with one of 20 perinatal psychiatrists who are true experts and can discuss a case with them. They can say, I have a mom that has this, that, or the other thing. I've prescribed this. It doesn't seem to be working. What do I do next?
Wow.
And we feel that's going to be a real game changer. And the reason that I'm bringing it up on this podcast is not only because I think there might be some prescribers listening, but for those moms, they can say to whoever they're seeing, if they don't think he or she is prescribing as well as they might be, listen, I would like you to do this. I would like you to call this number, and I would like you to talk to one of the perinatal psychiatrists who are experts and find out, you know, what might be a better choice. And I'm hoping that we will get moms able to say that, because I think it will really change things.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Those are great resources that you guys have. I mean, this is just outstanding. So Anne, your time has been amazing today. This is just incredible, incredible information. And I think that we're really going to end up changing a lot of people that are listening right now. A lot of parents that didn't realize, number one, that there is help out there. There's treatment available for them. And now they've got like a legitimate resource for them if they don't feel like they're getting satisfactory answers from maybe friends, family, and medical professionals. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I was proud and pleased to be with you. I agree. I think we've helped inform people about this. And I hope anybody who needs us will call or text to or go to the website postpartum.net or 1-800-944-4773. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiricone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.